Republicans to wake up. The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to. Do it live!
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Listeners support the Peter B. Collins Show, and if you can help, I'd like your help. Just log on to peterbcollins.com. The info's on my homepage. And this program is sponsored in part by Nancy Patterson of Winters, California. You can subscribe for as little as $5 a month, and everything helps. I appreciate it. This podcast is a one-on-one conversation with Professor Ravi Batra. He's a professor of economics at SMU. In this podcast, we will debut our new interactivity. Yes, you can now call in to the Peter B. Collins Show. It's not live, but we use the magic of voicemail. And our same toll-free number is available to you 24-7. It's 1-888-5-PETER-B, 888-573-8372. The number's on my website, too. And you can call with a comment about this show, about other issues, and when we find a place that it fits, we'll use your comment. It's that simple. 888-5-PETER-B. Also, one more credit. Jerry Taylor is a radio listener who I know listens to the Tom Hartman program and has been a longtime listener of mine. I don't actually know where he is located. But about 6 weeks ago, Jerry emailed me and said, you should have Dr. Batra on your program. And I yield to his request. And I've been hearing Ravi Batra on the Tom Hartman program for several years now, and always have found him compelling, interesting, and provocative. And really, with some respect for Tom, I didn't want to poach on one of his great contributors. But Jerry gave me the excuse. Professor, welcome to the Peter B. Collins Show.
Thanks a lot.
It's nice to talk with you. And first, if you could give us a little background on yourself. You have written numerous books, and you've made many predictions. And if Bush was the decider, I would dub you the predictor. And going back to the 1980s, or actually before that, you predicted the fall of the Shah. You predicted the breakup of the Soviet Union. You predicted an economic crisis in the 1990s that some people quibble with, but certainly many nations experienced it. And we're going to talk about some of your predictions in your latest book, The New Golden Age. But tell me, at what age did you start making predictions, and when when did you figure out that you had something special?
Well, my first predictions came in 1978 when I wrote this book, The Downfall of Capitalism and Communism. And my forecast was that the Soviet Union would collapse at the end of the century, and then after that would come the collapse of capitalism. But before capitalism falls, there will be some signs showing the imminent fall of the system. And the biggest sign would be the incredible jump in concentration of wealth. If wealth concentration becomes unprecedented, then for sure we know that the system, capitalism itself, is going to crash. And that's, in fact, the subject of my latest book, The New Golden Age. I've updated the material from that previous book and made numerous new forecasts, sometimes by the year. And that book was written in 2006, mm-hmm. And I made forecasts for 2007, 8, 9, 10, up to 2013. 2015. And strangely enough, all the forecasts have been coming true right on the year itself, or sometimes by the month itself.
Well, you got the real estate bubble in 2008.
That's right, bursting, and I predicted first the oil price would zoom, then collapse, and in fact, I think now that oil will stay high up to 2010, and then we'll have a really big crash. Yeah.
Well, I want to get to the law of social cycles, and have you explain for our listeners a little bit about what's behind some of your forecasts. But let me first confess to you, Professor, that I hit the wall in Econ 101. That Samuelson text was too much for me, and I had one of those auditorium, 300, you know, members of the class with a Professor Eisner who rambled on at great length. This was at Northwestern. And so I disclaim any expertise in economics, and I appreciate that you explain things in ways that even people like me can understand. Now, one of the things that I have been predicting since the 1970s, not based on any economic theory or laws as you use for your forecast, is that the United States has peaked and that we are a declining empire, that we fail to recognize that, much the way Britain failed to recognize its decline when that became very clear. And you can go back through history and see as empires rose and fell. And my own belief is that we are in the decline, that we have peaked, and that we have to come to terms with that. And we can either do so in a graceful manner that lets other nations ascend to our level, or we can fight to hold on to our supremacy until it is brutally wrested from us. Do you have any comment on my non-economic theory about empire?
Well, in fact, I have a chapter. Don't I have a chapter in that book called The U.S. Business Empire?
Yes, you do.
Yeah, okay. Mm-hmm. Yes, I agree with you that the business empire that the United States has amassed for a long time is going to collapse, is going to crash, and we are going to lose it. But that's not the end of the country itself. We will have other prominent nations as well, like China, India, and Europe, will be one of the big powers. But the United States, I think, will always have, or at least in the near future, will have an edge in the economy as well as in terms of new ideas.
Mm-hmm. And is it a combination of our innovation and some of the other factors that we attribute to the success of the American version of capitalism? Is it that? Is it our military power that we have used to preserve and extend the economic empire? Or is it the beauty of our political system? What do you see that sustains us and that also is our Achilles heel?
I think the biggest strength that the United States has is that it's open to foreigners. People of anybody from the rest of the world can come here and be free to make a good living and express his ideas. The country attracts a lot of talent from abroad, and that talent is able to solve the problems here. Whereas in some other countries, you don't have that kind of attraction. Russia doesn't have hardly any immigration. China does not. Japan also is more or less a closed society.
Mm-hmm.
But the biggest strength that the United States has is that people from outside the world come here and they innovate, they work very hard, and they're able to solve the country's problems. And right now, the country is going through huge problems, but I'm very confident that these problems are not intractable. They can be easily solved. They are there because of official corruption. Once the corruption goes away, and it will, people will one day be fed up soon, and they will throw out the corrupt regimes, corrupt officials, and then everything will be fine. That's why I call it the new golden age.
Mm-hmm.
Once corruption is gone, then you have the new golden age.
Well, unfortunately, the narcotic of television seems to keep Americans pretty placid. And, for example, we've seen that when elections were stolen in the Ukraine, more recently in Iran, and to a certain extent even more recently in Afghanistan, there's been a tremendous reaction. And in Iran and Ukraine, people took to the streets, and many people put their lives on the line for that specific issue. And I've looked carefully at the elections of 2000 and 2004, and I firmly believe that they were rigged and stolen. Yet the American people are passive about it. And I think part of the issue is that they see television as a credible source of information. And there's a whole lot missing and a whole lot that is heavily spun in terms of the information that people access via television in this country.
Well, look at the bright side of it. If it wasn't for George W. Bush, Americans would never wake up. I mean, he has woken up the people finally to the excesses of what the CEOs do, what the bankers do, how they pay themselves with millions and millions in compensation while laying off many other people. Now, these things were going on in the country for the past 10, 15, 20 years, but hardly any protests were there against this system. But now people have woken up, and they spoke against the system by electing Obama, President Obama. The trouble is that Mr. Obama himself has surrounded himself with the old guard, people with experience, and unfortunately, people with experience don't have new ideas. That's the problem.
Yeah.
But more change is coming.
Well, we're going to come back to the Obama economic team in a few minutes. I'd like you to take a moment here and explain your concept of trickleism to our listeners.
Well, trickleism is simply a theory that prosperity will trickle down from the very rich to the middle class and eventually to the poor, and so give all sorts of resources, all sorts of tax breaks to the rich corporations and the wealthy individuals. They will then invest money in factories, and by so doing, they will hire people and offer at decent wages, and eventually prosperity will spread to the masses. That's the theory, the trickle-down economics, and I call it trickleism. And that's a totally flawed theory. It's, of course, a self-serving idea which was concocted by President Reagan and his team, and it has been a dismal failure ever since then. But the propaganda machine of the government and of the big business CEOs, not CEOs, every CEO, but big business CEO, because of all that propaganda, it remained in action for a long time, but now people are seeing through it. And so trickleism, the opposite of trickleism is spreading the prosperity first to the low-level, low-income people, then to the middle class, and finally it goes to the rich. And that's the theory that works and has worked throughout American history. This time around, it was turned upside down in the early 80s, and ever since then, you can see the country has been going more and more into debt. The consumers have been going more and more into debt, and the living standard for the U.S. society has been falling. The propaganda is that the living standard is rising. No, it has been going down, and the biggest proof of that is that people have no savings. They're going into debt. If you have to go into debt to maintain your lifestyle, that means your living standard is going down.
Now, Professor, in reading your book, I heard a voice that is a contrarian in terms of the insider group of economists in this country. You are rare in that you speak up for the poor and the working class, and you see the value of their contributions as much more significant than many of your peers. And I wonder if we should add corruption of, the economic experts to the list there, because they embraced trickleism. They embraced continuity last year to allow the same people who wrecked our economy to try to fix it. And in my view, you are so refreshing because you're willing to put your skills to work in an objective and critical way.
Well, not just my skills to work, but also put my neck out there.
Yes, you have done that.
Yeah, I have suffered a lot in the past 10, 20 years because of my views, but I've felt that somebody had to do something to educate the public, and so I kept writing these books. In fact, there is another book I wrote, I think that was 2005, and called it Greenspan's Fraud.
Yeah.
Now, imagine that, is writing in 2005 when the guy was still the Fed chairman. I mean, somebody today saying Ben Bernanke's fraud, I mean, people will go after him. Not people, but the officials will go after him, or the media would go after him.
Mm-hmm.
Here in 2005, I wrote about what Greenspan had been doing for the past 20 years, how he was systematically laying the foundations for wrecking the economy. And pretty soon I wrote that the economy would, the wreck would show itself. And so when I wrote Greenspan's fraud, I got a lot of bad press and a lot of insults from the public saying, oh, look, here he goes again trying to attract attention with his bogus arguments and so on. But
and can I just speculate that Citigroup didn't hire you for a six-figure amount to give a speech, oh, like they did for Larry Summers just before he became, you know, a top advisor to Obama?
Well, Citigroup and Bank of America, Citigroup and many other bankers, they hate me. Wall Street hates me because I tell the truth, and even Greenspan now admits that he was wrong. But at the same time, he says, I don't know what happened, what I did wrong. Well, he should read the book, and he would know, to read Greenspan's fraud, and he would know what he did wrong.
We're talking with Professor Ravi Batra here on the Peter B. Collins Show. And now, Professor, we don't have commercial breaks, and I want to give you as much time as you need here to explain to our listeners, in terms that I can understand, your law of social cycles and how it has influenced your forecasts and predictions, and then we'll apply that to the current situation for the United States and some of the predictions that you have made in our very near future, or for our very near future.
Well, the law of social cycles is very profound, but it can be explained in a very simple way as well. What this law says is that in every society, in every civilization, in every country, there are only three sources of political power, three possible ways you can get political power. One way is through the physical strength or physical might, and that's the military's way. So the other way is through your intellect. If a person is very smart, then he or she can rise to the level of the president or become a prime minister or so on. So one is physical force, the other is human intellect. The third source of political power is good old money. That's what we have today. Money is the main source of political power today. So there are only three possible sources of political power: human intellect, physical force, and wealth or money. And if you look at the history of any society, you find that there is a cycle in which these three forces move. In every civilization, first came the rule of the military. That was physical force. Then came the rule of human intellect or intellectuals. That was human intellect. After that came the rule of the wealthy, or I call them acquisitors, the rule of acquisitors. And the rule of acquisitors created so much materialism and wealth concentration that in the end there was no other way out for society except to revolt against them, and so there was a social revolution. After that social revolution, we went back to the age of the physical might or the military power, again followed by the rule of intellectuals, again followed by the rule of acquisitors, and again a social revolution, and on this way the civilizations evolve in terms of this cycle, which is called the law of social cycles. So first the rule of the physical force, then human intellect, then wealth, followed by revolution, and so on. And I use this law to illustrate the history of so many societies, and I found that this law applied to all of them. Like, look at the Western world, for instance. You start out, say, with the Roman Empire. That's going pretty far back. The Roman Empire is the rule of the physical force or the military class.
Mm-hmm.
Then came the rule of the Catholic Church. how did the church rule society? With the help of its ideas, by controlling the ideas, and the ideas come from human intellect.
Mm-hmm.
That was the rule of intellectuals or rule of ideas. After the Catholic Church had ruled for 300-400 years, then came feudalism. The feudal landlords controlled society with the help of land. Land was wealth at that time. When, if you controlled land, you were the wealthiest person on earth. So, and then then feudalism ended up in a social revolution of the warriors, of the military class, and the military class came back, and we had the age of the warrior for another 200 years. After that came prime ministers who ruled for also 200 years or so. That was another age of intellectuals. Since about 1860s, the United States and the Western world have been in the age of acquisitors, where money controls politics and everything else in society.
Mm-hmm.
And so my forecast is now this age of money or the age of wealth is going to end in a social revolution, and the biggest symptom of that revolution is extreme concentration of wealth. When wealth becomes extremely concentrated, then the rest of society becomes very poor, and out of poverty, they are simply forced to revolt. And so that's the phase we are entering in now. The country is becoming very, very poor because of rising unemployment and the concentration of wealth is at its extreme. While people are falling into poverty, companies like Goldman Sachs are giving billions of dollars in bonuses to their CEOs and managers. So these are the kind of things that invite a rebellion from the masses. Then there is a social revolution, and after the social revolution comes a golden age. And that's what... So the end result of this revolution, we are in for a few years of increasing poverty, but the end result will be fantastic.
And Professor, in your book, you have a fascinating table here, which compares the end of feudalism with the end of capitalism. And you describe us in a pre-revolutionary stage at this point. And there are nine factors here, and let's go through them. Feudalism, you describe landlords demand concessions from former serfs, and you compare that with companies demanding wage concessions from workers, and I would add outsourcing to that bullet point. Number two, at the end of feudalism, wealth concentration rising sharply, and there you compare that with what you just described, the incredible amounts that we pay our top executives. And I don't have that in front of me, but it's hundreds of times greater than the average hourly worker now, right?
Well, in 1960, the big business CEO, you know, not all CEOs, you have a big business CEO is in a class by himself.
Mm-hmm.
A big business CEO earned about 40 times the average wage in society, which is still pretty good, you know, 40 times the average wage in America.
I'll take it.
Yeah, right. And today, it's 500 times the average wage in America. So it is one incredible jump has occurred in society, in the wealth concentration.
Indeed. The third point, rampant crime near anarchy. And you described the contemporary situation, growing population of prisoners and criminals. That's certainly a fact. Number four, rising poverty among the people. And you didn't even bother to change the language, rising poverty among the people. And that's a very clear indication. And they play games with us. Here in California, where we've got this Austrian-born action movie star playing governor, they pretend that they're doing us a favor by not raising taxes. But they're raising fees, they're closing the parks. The University of California has had 277% increases in tuition and fees in the last 6 years. And those are tax increases on working people. Only, you know, the spin that we get from Grover Norquist and his acolytes is that, you know, low taxes, even at the expense of gutting critical government services and the stimulative effect that government spending has, well, they just want to focus on the tax issue because that's what's important to those who are already set.
That's exactly true, exactly right. And So there are a lot of symptoms, as you can point out, and those are the symptoms of the coming revolution.
Number five, in the feudal era, people infuriated with feudal barons. In the contemporary, people enraged by CEO scandals. Number six, an epidemic of official incompetence, and you repeat that too, and we see that in the war in Iraq. We see it in the response to Hurricane Katrina, and we see it in many other respects as well. Number seven, growing public unrest because of warfare, and you define that in the current situation as the Iraq War, killing soldiers, creating unrest, and destroying army morale. Then number eight, unusual natural calamities, especially drought and pestilence. You compare that with tsunamis, hurricanes, earthquakes, and other disasters, and some of those can be linked to climate change, which is at least influenced heavily by human behavior. And number nine, Black Death or plague, and you compare that to the spread of AIDS, HIV, and the avian flu pandemic. You couldn't have known at the time you published the book about the more serious H1N1 or swine flu pandemic, which is just starting to really, to explode worldwide.
That's right. The whole idea is that this law of social cycle is a natural law. It's part of nature's law, and nature also gives its helping hand towards the end of a system. The system is coming to an end, and the nature is also doing its job. So that's why I mentioned some things like tsunamis and the spread of AIDS, etc., to show that it's part of natural order, and therefore it's inevitable. It's coming. It is simply inevitable.
And a little bit later, in the same chapter, you write, like any other empire, the American business empire will also fall. The question is not if, but when. The capitalistic era of acquisitors is about to end, the same way Soviet communism collapsed right before our eyes. As nearly as anyone can predict these things, I expect that the beginning of the end will start around 2009. Now, you wrote this almost 3 years ago. Do you want to fine-tune that prediction at this point, Professor?
No, in fact, it did start around 2009. Maybe it started in 2008. In the month of September,
Lehman Brothers?
That's right, Lehman Brothers and AIG and Merrill Lynch, and so all of these were collapsing at that time, and the government had to come to their rescue. So it started out, I think, towards the end of 2008 and got worse this year. So you can say that that forecast was more or less correct.
Mm-hmm. And so take a moment here to describe what has happened over the past year, because I have to say that as I have watched the news accounts and seen the reaction of our government and the political rhetoric that flies above the economic problems, number one, I have never been fully persuaded that we had a real credit crunch. And it seemed to me that when the banks in their, the overnight lending that they do between one another, when some of that credit dried up, that was arbitrary. That was controlled by the banks. And so I'd like to know your thoughts, Professor, to what extent the financial industry and the titans in this country created a phony hysteria and exaggerated the extent of the problems that were there.
Well, I think the problem was that Goldman Sachs was in big trouble. And their former CEO was the Treasury Secretary. And he wanted to bail out Goldman Sachs and some other banks. And so he concocted the idea that, well, we're facing a dire financial crisis, the worst since the Great Depression, and so we need to act immediately without asking any questions. And he then had Congress pass, $700 or more billion bailout.
Mm-hmm. 700.
Something like that. And that was the problem. See, our governments, including the Obama administration, have wasted, I think, $3 trillion. On bailing out Wall Street and banks. And I call it a total waste of money.
Mm-hmm.
The reason being that if there is a problem, you have to first fix its cause, not its symptom. These people don't understand economics, therefore they are trying to fix the symptom and not the cause. The cause of our economic troubles is very simple. It's a matter of supply and demand. I mean, every problem in economics can be understood if you just focus on supply and demand. And these guys don't do that. They just talk about taxes, money supply, budget deficit, but they don't go to the basic fundamentals, which are supply and demand. And let me explain in a very simple way what the real problem is. Now, what's the main source of supply? The main source of supply is labor productivity. When workers become more productive, output goes up, so supply rises. So the main source of supply is labor productivity. Then what's the main source of demand? The main source of demand are wages. The same workers who produce a lot are also the one who create demand through their when they have wages, through their wages.
Right.
So in because of innovation and because of new technology, productivity rises every year. So if you want a supply-demand balance to be maintained, then wages have to rise every year as well, in the same proportion as the rise in productivity.
Mm-hmm.
Now, from about 1950 to 1980, we find that the government economic policies were such that whenever productivity went up, wages also went up in the same proportion, and so we did not have many economic problems. We had some, but not too many. But after 1980, economic policy changed so much that wages no longer went up while productivity kept rising. So when productivity rises and wages don't, supply went up very fast, demand did not. So when supply is greater than demand, there is immediate problem, and the problem is there is overproduction. There is too much production, not enough demand, and whenever there is overproduction, businesses are not able to sell their goods, they will have to lay off people. So after 1980, this problem of potential overproduction began to appear. Now, there is another way in which you can solve the problem. If you don't want to raise wages, and believe me, President Reagan and his team did not want to see wages rise. They did not even allow the minimum wage to rise for several years. So if you don't want to allow the wages to rise, then there is another way you can solve this problem, which can postpone it for a while, and that is to create debt. And that's why you find that ever since Reagan took over, budget deficit, first the budget deficit, and then the government debt began to skyrocket. Now, even that rise in debt was not enough to create enough demand so that supply will be in balance with demand. So we find that there was a stock market crash in 1987. Then Greenspan took over, and Greenspan began to reduce interest rates sharply so that the public will borrow money and have more of its own debt. So ever since 1980, the government in the United States has been following a policy that raises the government debt as well as consumer debt, and the purpose is to raise demand to the level of supply. Since wages are not allowed to rise much, and wages are not rising at all, productivity rises every year, so they are creating more and more debt so that demand will rise to the level of supply. And this way, they were able to postpone the problem for a very long time. But unfortunately, or fortunately maybe, productivity rises every year. That means debt has to rise every year if you want to keep postponing the problem.
Mm-hmm.
And in this scenario, you can easily visualize or envision a time would come when debt cannot rise anymore. The banks have taken so much risk already. People have used up their collateral already. The banks will not lend anymore. Then immediately a crisis would start. So the banking crisis is not the cause of our troubles. The cause is the rising wage productivity gap. That's the cause. And until you fix that cause, we cannot come out of this recession, no matter how hard we try.
And, Professor, what about the interaction of the syndication of debt, where we've been able to persuade Saudi Arabia and China and others to buy our paper, and that would further delay the day of reckoning, and the manner in which we ran up huge amounts of debt for the purpose of funding tax cuts and financing wars? These, to me, seem to be huge blunders that were done intentionally and recklessly.
Well, that's where the official corruption comes in. But let's go back. First, go back to this China and Japan buying our paper so much. Well, they also have the same problem. They are following our system in which productivity rises fast and wages don't. So they also have the problem of excess production or oversupply. Supply is rising, has been rising fast there as well. So that they are also facing the same trouble. And what was their solution? They simply wanted to export their surplus abroad. See, their people don't want to go into debt. Their people want to save money, like to save money. They don't want to go into debt. So they followed a policy of undervalued exchange rate. This way they could send their excess production abroad and export their employment to other countries, unemployment to other countries. So, but the problem is the same. The rising wage productivity gap is the cause of export surpluses in China and Japan, and it's the same thing is the cause of banking crisis and eventual stock market crashes, etc., in the United States and in the Western world.
And I also see the twin effects of our ballooning trade deficit and outsourcing. So at the same time that we are reducing wages and the job count for people in the United States, we are relying more and more on imports. And this is a downward spiral that has a very ugly ending.
Well, that's from the official policy of free trade. That reflects official corruption. Also, this way, the big business CEO can first of all locate his factories abroad and then bring those goods at a very cheap rate in the United States because there are no tariffs. And so the prices don't come down that much. Since prices don't fall that much, only wages fall. The result is that the big business CEO rakes in a huge amount of money and awards himself billions of dollars in compensation.
Mm-hmm. So then, is there a way out of this, or is this simply a part of our decline that really can't be, we can't put the brakes on it?
Well, no, there is an easy way out of it. After all, as I said earlier, from 1950 to 1980, we followed policies that enabled wages to rise in the same proportion as productivity. So if we were to go back to those policies, all these problems would quickly disappear.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. Now, Professor, in your book, you take a couple of whacks at Paul Krugman, the Nobel Prize-winning economist from Princeton. And he's a very accessible guy. I've interviewed him a couple of times. I enjoy him, and he certainly seems bright. But you criticized him for some columns he wrote, I think, in 2004 or about that time, where he was predicting deflation, and also that he seems to be an apologist for outsourcing.
Right, exactly. And, yeah, he was predicting deflation. That did not occur. And of course, he kept saying outsourcing is just like free trade, and since free trade is good for America, outsourcing must be good for the country as well. Well, first of all, free trade has not been good for America at all. And outsourcing is even worse than free trade, because in outsourcing, you have double jeopardy. When you outsource a product, it creates supply, it increases supply, but the production is, but the wages are spent outside your country. So in this case, production goes up in the United States because some work is done by a worker abroad. But the wages of that worker are spent abroad, so there is no corresponding demand at all in the U.S. Only supply goes up, so that actually exacerbates, makes it worse.
Mm-hmm.
The problem of oversupply becomes worse through outsourcing. So outsourcing is even worse than free trade.
And Professor, tell me who you do have confidence in besides yourself, and let me name two people who I have a high regard for. One is Elizabeth Warren, the professor from Harvard who's been put in charge of oversight of the TARP money. And I find her refreshingly honest and disarmingly candid, particularly in her public comments. The other is...
She's very bright, and she's and the good part is she's not an economist. See, otherwise, she would be also perhaps preaching the ways of orthodox or traditional economics. These economists are... have been paid out, have been bought out by big business CEOs. I mean, look at their titles. Somebody, as I mentioned, somebody is, what is it, Rockefeller Professor of Economics. Somebody
yeah.
is maybe, you know, Bates Professor of Economics. I don't know. These people have been bought off by big business CEOs, and they toe the lines of all these large companies. Warren... Elizabeth, is it Elizabeth Warren?
Elizabeth, yes.
Uh-huh. Yeah. She is not an economist, and she is an attorney. Is she an attorney?
I think she's a law professor, yeah.
Law professor, right.
Mm-hmm.
She is very bright, and she's very honest, as you said, and so I have good confidence in her. And as far as economics is concerned, if you follow common sense, anybody can understand it. And whatever I talked to you about just now, it's purely common sense, productivity versus wages, and productivity being the source of supply, wages being the source of demand. Both have to rise in the same proportion if you want a healthy economy. It's as simple as that.
Now, what about Joe Stiglitz? Do you think he's a credible commentator?
Joe Stiglitz, I think, is better than others. And he's not too much against free trade, but he also doesn't like the deficit as it is today. I would rather have him in the White House than Larry Summers.
Mm-hmm. And if you care to, and it could be a short list, but who else would you recommend to my listeners who you respect in terms of their economic intelligence and their independence in presenting their views?
Well, there's one other person who comes to mind, and that is James Galbraith Jr.
At
UT Austin.
Yeah, I've talked to him. He's really a straight shooter.
Yeah, and so he's pretty good. Then there's a good friend of mine. He is very outspoken and very candid, but hardly anybody has heard of him. He is a visiting fellow at Harvard University. What's his name? He's from India.
Mm-hmm.
And Rajani Kant.
Okay.
I'm forgetting his name, but he's Rajani Kant.
Well, I've put you on the spot. Sorry about that. But I just thought it'd be interesting to see if you have a short list of people. Now, let me ask you, what is the number that you place on the amount of money that the Fed and Treasury have either pumped into the economy or committed to the banking sector and the financial sector in the past year? Because, you know, I saw Ben Bernanke on the Public News Hour. He did this town hall meeting in Kansas City this summer, and he was focused, it was narrowly focused on the TARP money, as if that is the entire amount that has been used to subsidize the financial sector during this past year.
Well, a few days ago, I thought of writing an article, which is still in my mind, but because of the lack of time, I haven't been able to do that. And the title of this article was going to be $3 trillion for Wall Street and $3 billion for the auto buyer. I think on the Tom Hartman show itself, 1 year ago, I suggested that the government is wasting so much money. Instead of spending all that money on Wall Street, they should give tax credit to the auto buyer, and they should focus on the auto industry and the housing industry.
Mm-hmm.
And with a very little amount of money, we can fix the economy if you just make people buy cars.
Yeah.
So finally, they thought of this Cash for Clunkers program, and it's already over.
Yeah.
With $3 billion, It's already over. And they've spent $3 trillion on Wall Street. I think it's $3 trillion, not just the TARP money, but also all the money that the Fed has given to Bank of America and Goldman Sachs. And by the way, this time, Goldman Sachs and the like are using taxpayer money to raise the price of oil for us. That comes as a, might come as a shock to you, but why is the price of oil so high? And how was I able to make this forecast, say, in 2006? Mm-hmm. I wrote that the oil price is going to zoom and then will fall just as fast. And I looked at the way Goldman Sachs was operating. So I knew that through their speculation, they will raise the price of oil sharply, but eventually supply-demand would take over and the price would fall sharply too. And now they're doing the same thing. In January of this year, oil fell to about $35 a barrel. Mm-hmm. Now it's back to 70 again. Why is it back? Because Goldman Sachs is busy speculating again, and this time they're using the taxpayer money mm-hmm. on their trading.
Professor, going back a moment to the auto industry, I fully agree with you, and I only have one friendly amendment. I believe that by Christmas last year, we should have put in front of the auto industry not these loans that were advanced to them for the purpose of laying off workers and shutting down plants and making the problem worse, but that we should have ordered 500,000 cars, and we should have ordered the cars we want. We should have forced General Motors and let Rick Wagoner keep his sorry job if he'd give us 500,000 electric cars within a year. And likewise, if they would have brought the fleet mileage standards up and brought us more hybrids and alternative fuel cars, I think that pump could have been primed by using federal money or subsidies to consumers to essentially force the auto industry to retool in a green direction.
Well, this is the same. This is a step in the right direction. The main thing is it's a focus on the auto industry. And what I said was this, which is similar to what you proposed. What I said was this. Offer this 20% credit or up to $4,500, as they did, to an auto buyer, to a car buyer, and say that the car has to be made on the American soil. The car should be made in America. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter if Toyota builds it or Honda does it, but it should be built on the American soil. And then some people said to me, well, this sounds like protectionism. I said, no, it doesn't sound like protectionism. It is simply government's fiscal policy. The government is using its money. Protectionism would be when you tell the public not to buy foreign goods. But here the government is subsidizing it. Government is using its money, and they are directing their fiscal policy towards the American economy. So, and this is one thing they did wrong in their Cash for Clunkers program. They did not stipulate that the car had to be built in America.
Right, yeah. Professor, comment, if you would, on one of my pet theories. When it comes to executive compensation, when it comes to the way corporations are managed for the benefit of management and not shareholders, it seems to me that the corporate system, the limited liability structure, is brilliant in so many ways. But we have failed to enforce the fiduciary rules that would require directors to represent the shareholders instead of their cronies in management. And I feel if we had a couple of high-profile prosecutions of directors who have failed in their fiduciary responsibilities, that we could sharply shift the culture in this country. It would reduce this obscene compensation to executives, and it also might restore dividends so that people, average people who buy shares, would get a return on their investment, not just speculate casino-style, that the shares are going to run up and that they'll make money when they sell them in a capital gains mode. What are your thoughts about this?
Well, these people, the big business CEOs, are certainly corrupt. But how they work is how they work. They corrupt the politicians. They give them a lot of money for their campaigns, and the politicians then pass laws which suppress wages but allow, through outsourcing and through free trade, they allow all sorts of foreign goods to come in. So wages are suppressed, but productivity keeps rising. The profits go sky high, and this is how these CEOs make a lot of money. But of course, they need the help of directors. So the CEO appoint directors. The directors in turn reward the CEO, and this way it goes on and on. So this is a culture of corruption that is initiated by the CEO, and the politician is playing a part in it.
Mm-hmm. Professor, at the beginning, I mentioned that we have new interactivity here at the Peter B. Collins podcast, and I have a caller for you. I'm going to play the call right now and see if you have a response. And to prime the pump here and get more people to participate by phone in our program, Bill O'Reitz Man in Cleveland is going to get a prize package of books and DVDs from the Peter B. Collins Show. And next time, you can call in toll-free 24-7. Just leave your comment or question at 888-5-PETER-B.
Man in Cleveland, I wanted to ask Ravi Batra what he thought about the IMF selling 400 tons of gold. That's interesting.
All right. Thank you, Bill O'Reitz, man. And he had his rock and roll playing in the background, Professor. What he asked you was, have you heard that the IMF has sold 400 tons of gold? It was news to me.
The IMF has been selling gold periodically, but there is so much uncertainty in the world today that that there is a lot of demand for gold, and so in spite of that, gold price has been breaking records.
Mm-hmm. And that dovetails with a question that was emailed in from Craig. He said, "Professor, I've heard you along with talk show hosts and their guests advocate buying gold in European-denominated securities. Isn't that exactly wrong? The opposite of stimulating the economy by investing in America?"
Well, if it was up to one person, every person has to protect himself, knowing that the official corruption is not going to go away. So, yes, the best thing would be if you could make the politicians work or offer right policies, but we know that's not going to happen. So in that case, everybody has to protect himself.
And, Professor, I have another question from Craig, but I first want to acknowledge that we didn't touch on a very important section of your book where you analyze the Muslim world and its rise and fall over centuries related to your theory, the law of social cycles. And I recommend that to people because it gives you a fascinating look at the part of the world that we have declared to be our enemy, and I think it's very rich and valuable. What Craig wanted to ask is, he said, it increasingly appears that Israel pretty much owns the nuts and bolts of our intelligence community, that Israel controls this nation's government and foreign policy. And if that were the case, he said, should those of us who are aware of this reality be petitioning our government, and what should we be petitioning them for?
Well, I think Israel has has a lot of friends in the United States, in Congress especially, and they do have some influence on U.S. Economic and foreign policy. But I think it's an exaggeration to say that they determine our policy. So I really don't have much else to say on this.
Okay. Well, Craig, I tend to agree. I wouldn't use your language, but I would say that Israel has too much influence on the United States, and we see it reflected in many aspects of the problems that we face today. In closing, Professor, I want to ask you to amplify a little bit on something toward the end of your book that you call the voting strategy, and I'd call it the Batra Manifesto. You basically outline six critical issues, and you say that we should be electing leaders who support this agenda. Number one, raise the minimum wage and filibuster the annual pay raise in the Senate until the minimum wage is first raised piecemeal to $8 an hour and then linked annually to the cost of living. Is $8 an hour enough?
Well, remember, this book was written in 2006.
Yes, okay.
I would raise it to now $9 per hour and then raise it and link it to the cost of living.
Mm-hmm.
But before I do that, right now we really have a bad economy. So first we need to focus on the auto industry and the housing industry. We should give an auto tax credit to every car buyer, to every car buyer and who wants to buy a car made in America. That's one thing. Secondly, we should give a foreclosure tax credit, the because the administration policy of sorting out applications and helping the foreclosures foreclosed housing industry that way is not, it's taking too much time.
Mm-hmm.
So just give a tax credit for those who are facing foreclosures, and that will be effective immediately, and then you can solve the housing industry problem very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
Once we have focus on these two industries, which are the biggest ones in America, then business would start to rise, would start to come back. At that point, we should slowly raise the minimum wage. We need to strengthen our business first and then slowly raise the minimum wage. The rise in the minimum wage will create demand in the economy, and that's what's lacking right now.
Number two, they're kind of working on it in Washington, but it's really disappointing. Offer universal health insurance based on a plan that you explain in the book. Why is health insurance so critical to rebalancing our economy?
Well, first of all, it's really bad for our businesses. We can't compete in the rest of the world because other countries subsidize health insurance. And I'm not even talking about subsidizing health this health insurance, just making it universal. First of all, it's the right thing to do, ethical thing to do. And secondly, it's good for our business.
Mm-hmm. All right, number three, break up the giant monopolies like ExxonMobil and Pfizer to bring down the price of oil and prescription drugs.
Well, that's the reason why oil prices went up so much. People say, well, you know, this is a huge demand rise from India and China that's creating demand for oil, and that's raising prices. Well, I would say when oil was at $147 per barrel last year, and now oil is at, say, $70. Demand from India and China are still there. It's still there. So it's not that demand. It's the monopoly element in the energy industry. Look at it this way. Almost everybody says today that we have the worst recession since the 1930s, and still oil is at $70 a barrel. Look at 1999. At that time, we had a worldwide recession, which was not as bad as what we have today. But oil was priced at $10 per barrel.
Yeah.
Just 10 years ago.
Yeah.
What has changed? OPEC is still there. OPEC was there in 1999 also. So it's not the OPEC which is creating a big rise in the price of oil. It is the oil industry and the speculative element from the likes of Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley and so on. So if we were to break up the oil industry like the way we did it in 1910, I think,
yeah,
then we can easily quickly bring the price of oil down to same $10-$20 a barrel as it was in 1999.
Your next point here needs a little explanation. Adopt the dual export exchange rate to revive manufacturing while preserving free trade.
Well, it needs some explanation. Other countries, especially China and Japan, have kept a very low exchange rate for their exports. Now, we can't do the same thing because our dollar is the central currency in the world.
Mm-hmm.
We could have a dual rate. One rate for export transactions and the other rate for everything else. And so for the export market, we would undervalue our dollar. The Federal Reserve can do that, manage that, the way the Bank of China and Bank of Japan do.
Mm-hmm.
So we have undervalued dollar for exports, but for everything, every other transaction, we have the free market dollar, the way what it is right now. So this way, it will be dual rate. And once we undervalue our dollar, our exports will rise sharply, but imports will not fall at all. So the plan is not to cut the imports because that might be against WTO rules or free trade. The plan is to raise our exports the way other countries are doing it, and so that's the dual exchange rate plan.
All right. Number five, raise the capital gains, dividend, and top bracket income tax rates to the maximum 40% level that prevailed under Bill Clinton, who balanced the federal budget. That's a no-brainer for me. And finally, I'm really glad to see this as an element of your list here, campaign finance reform. You say reject campaign contributions from big business, but I fear that the Roberts Court is working on a landmark reversal of issues related to this Hillary campaign movie, And I believe that they are likely to affirm corporate personhood and actually expand on the freedoms of corporations to participate in our electoral process. I hope I'm wrong about that, but that's my fear. I don't know if Sonia Sotomayor can make the kind of difference in the oral arguments. It seems that she's fundamentally opposed to this, but it looks like the majority is not.
Whether it's Robert's Court, hello?
Yeah, I'm still here. Go ahead, Professor.
Whether it's Robert's Court or anybody else, nobody can stop the evolutionary process of society. No, this law of social cycle is part of a natural order. And believe me, in 1978, when I wrote that the Soviet communism would be gone by the end of the century, I was looking at the rest of their history. And the law of social cycle can be delayed, but it cannot be stopped.
Mm-hmm.
So the social revolution that I talk about is on its way, and whether it's the Roberts Court or somebody else's court, they won't be able to stop it. They might be able to delay it somewhat, but mm-hmm. they won't be able to stop it, and the end result is fantastic. Once the rule of money is gone, we will have a golden age, a great new living standard, high living standard, and changes in tax policy, changes in the way we think would all follow.
Well, Professor, thank you for spending this hour with me today. I've certainly learned a lot. I appreciate understanding your perspective and sharing it with our listeners. And I look forward to partying with you in the new golden age.
Thank you.
Great to talk with you. Thanks for listening to this episode of the Peter B. Collins Show, and I'll see you in the new golden age. Send me an email. Let me know what you think.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until